Well, good morning, everyone. It's awfully nice to be here. I actually appreciate the opportunity to come and speak to all of you. If you've ever given a message standing in a room by yourself, then you probably understand why I hate that. But that's what we do on some of these quarterly messages. We go into the studio, they turn the camera on, everybody leaves, and you're standing there all by yourself speaking as though there's a group there. And it's a very unnerving experience. I've not gotten used to it, so I'm very happy to actually be able to present my material to all of you here. Just a few comments before I get into the message. We did arrive back from Ghana this past Tuesday, actually. We were there for a week for leadership classes. We're actually taking this program around the world. We truly have... crisis is, again, maybe not an overstatement. I think there is truly a crisis, not as much in the United States as it is around the world. Within the last 18 months, we lost three pastors to death suddenly, and two of them were outside the United States. Now, in the one in the U.S., Mr. Todd Carey, we shifted some responsibilities around. Neighboring pastors picked up his congregations, and that worked out okay. Then we lost the pastor in Peru, Mr. Quijano, and he was the only, for a long time, he was the only minister in Peru. And we ordained an elder there about 3 or 4 years ago, I believe, and Mr. Quijano also died rather suddenly. And how do you replace him? Where do we find a pastor for the country of Peru? About 230 members in Peru, I think, 7 or 8 congregations. And so Mr. Cervera was the elder there, and he took on the responsibility as pastor and is doing a fine job. But how do you replace pastors in that sense? Then we lost Mr. Ulagay, who was our youngest pastor in the Philippines, died suddenly of a heart attack. All of that in the last 18 months. It just emphasized the issues that we're facing, especially outside the United States. If you look at it from the overall perspective, we have approximately 11,000, couple hundred people attending the Church of God of Worldwide Association. It's almost evenly divided between the United States and those outside the United States. But 75% of all the elders live in the United States. So 25% of the elders in the Church of God, a worldwide association, are serving half the church. And so you can imagine, we have elders serving several countries. And so where will the new leadership come from? Well, obviously, we're not going to the Baptist seminary and take applications. It has to come from within the church. And how do we educate individuals, especially outside the United States, so that they can be, of course, competent and qualified to pastor congregations? So we began a program called the International Leadership Program last year, and the program is designed to go around the world and initiate a program that will culminate, we hope, in certainly new elders, potential individuals who can come along, get more education and training, and be able to take on responsibility of leadership outside the U.S. We have several programs in the U.S. for developing leadership, but we had nothing outside the U.S. Mr. Leon Walker, who's our oldest employee, elder in the church, and has been around a long time, said there's never been anything in his lifetime like this done in the Church of God, where we have a program that's going around the world and with the same program in every part of the world to develop leadership. So it's a very ambitious program. The latest, we have 10 regions of the world that we're going to travel to. We did four last year, and now one this year, and we've got five more to go before the end of this year. And so it's a pretty ambitious schedule. But we got back from Ghana on Tuesday. In order to get to Ghana, of course, you fly from Dallas. We flew from Dallas to London, London to Accra, Ghana, and then, of course, spent a week there, then repeated that on the way back. So from the time we left Accra, which was Monday night, we were 24 hours before we got back home to Dallas. The trip from London to, it's about 6 hours, actually about 7 hours of flight from Ghana to London, and then London to Dallas turned out to be 11 hours. We had a strong headwind, I guess, and it was going over was like 8 or 9, but coming back it was 11 hours. So we arrived back on Tuesday, late Tuesday afternoon. All went well. Ghana has our largest membership outside the United States of any one country. We have approximately 700 members in Ghana. Ghana is a unique situation in that it was a large group that came from the Church of God Seventh Day that contacted us 20 years ago now and became a part of, at that time, of course, the United Church of God, and now they're all a part of the Church of God, a worldwide association. But their background was Church of God Seventh Day. And so it's been a long process of working with them, educating the ministry there, and bringing them along. I think we often take for granted what we had, and I think many of you, of course, go back to the Worldwide Church of God days. And the culture and the background we had in the Worldwide Church of God, and even Radio Church of God, that you really can't duplicate. You know, you take for granted, well, this is the way things are, and you find out, well, no, that's not the way things are for those who have no experience like that. And it requires a lot of work, biblical education, knowledge of Scripture, and we're still working with that. But we had a good turnout. We had about 60 individuals attend the leadership meetings from Nigeria and Ghana. And, of course, Nigeria is a whole different ball game in that sense. But it's very successful. We're very happy to do it. We follow up with classes. The program consists of a weekend of lectures, a class program that follows that we actually broadcast. We have one tomorrow morning that's being broadcast to the Philippines. And so we'll be broadcasting, webcasting to different parts of the world, follow-up classes for education. So we're doing everything we can to try to make sure we deal with the things that we're working with. And really, it is a crisis in just simply having leadership. We know, and again, it's not to that we don't understand that, without good leadership, without good shepherds, it becomes really problematic. We all need leadership. We all need individuals that are not only educated in Scripture and able to explain and expound the Scriptures, but again, committed, dedicated to God's way of life, converted individuals who can become the leaders in these different parts of the world. So that's a big part of what we're doing now. So we just got back from Ghana. In 2 weeks, we leave for New Zealand. We'll have a conference for New Zealand, Australia, Fiji, Tonga, and I believe that's it as far as the ones it'll be in New Zealand. We'll have, again, about 60 individuals, husbands and wives. It'll be a part of that conference. And so that's coming up in a couple of weeks. So that's what we've been doing, a big part of it. We're also, of course, very anxious to move into the building. This has been a long process, but it's just about to the end. We actually have secured a moving company that's moving everything on Monday, February 25th. We actually now have a date, and we just hope we meet that date. We'll see what the city of McKinney has to say. We'll be waiting on the final occupancy permits that we pray will not be a problem, and that'll all work out. Because we've actually gone into February, which we did not plan to do, the builder has agreed to pay part of the rent where we are for February, so we were happy to work that out so that we'll be able to well, again, get a little recovery from that, because we're not only are we paying on a mortgage, of course, we're paying interest only during the construction period, but we're also paying rent where we are. And so the builder has agreed, because of so many delays that we've had, that they'll cover a part of the February rent. So we're good till February 28th if we needed it where we are, but we've got a move-in date of February 25th. It should all be done in one day. So we should be up and operating in the new building either the 26th or the 27th or the 28th or March 1st or April 1st or somewhere in there we'll hopefully be up and operating. So we're all excited about that. So between the travel and the building and all of that, it's certainly taken a lot of time. But we're excited. We're really happy. I think once you see the building, if you have an opportunity to come over, it's a very nice building, a very quality building. We're very happy with that. Good location, But at the end of the day, it's still just an office building, so it's not anything greater than that. But we're happy. It'll provide us with a space that we've not had before, and the opportunity to do a lot of things. So we're again very excited about that. Also, wanted to mention before I left on Friday, Ina McLemore told me to not only tell you all hello, but to give you an update on her health. Ina now has a date for surgery. Ina was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she's having surgery on Monday, February the 4th, and would appreciate all of your prayers on her behalf. She's very optimistic and, of course, believe that they certainly can take care of it through surgery. So that's set up for February the 4th. Well, I'm happy to be here. As I mentioned, my wife and I are here. We came yesterday. It's going to be a short turnaround because of so many activities that we have. We have, of course, the leadership class actually is tomorrow. Actually, it's broadcast, I think, tonight, but because of the time in the Philippines. So we'll webcast at 8 o'clock tonight, and they'll see it at 10 o'clock tomorrow. But 8 o'clock tonight will be 10 o'clock their time. So it's live in that sense, webcast, but it'll actually be seen by them at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. So that's another class that we're working on. And then, of course, getting ready for the move-in, as well as getting prepared for the next trip. So we felt we needed to get back home, so we're leaving tonight to go back home. But it's an hour flight up to Dallas, so it's I didn't even realize it. I got on the plane and we landed. Wasn't anything like the planes I've been on recently, so that was really a good deal. And we were very, very happy to come down with Mr. Sandlin and ask us. We appreciate the offer and appreciate being here with all of you. Well, today I'm going to talk about church history. My personal experience with church history goes back to when I was a student at Ambassador College. My interest was piqued at that time, and I've had a very serious interest in the subject ever since. I was a freshman at Ambassador College, as I said, and the second semester of class at Ambassador College had about a six-week period of time to teach church history. Now, church history, we're referring to the almost 2,000 years from the founding of the church in 31 AD up to modern time. It was a very interesting subject. It was something that, as I said, caught my interest and made me want to study more about that because we only covered in very general. But, you go on with your life. I graduate from Ambassador College. You marry. You have a family. You're working as in the ministry. And so things get put aside. And that's pretty much what happened. But the study of church history is something that is really important to the church. It's something that we've seen in the church over time. The modern-day Church of God has a history of writing on this subject. In fact, Clarence O. Dodd and Andrew N. Duggar, both leaders in the Church of God Seventh-day from the Salem, West Virginia branch of the Church of God Seventh-day. You have to realize that in 1931, the Church of God Seventh-day split in two in the United States. The Stanbury branch remained Stanbury, and then, of course, the Salem, West Virginia branch began. They actually remained separate as separate organizations until 1949, and then they combined again, and today they have their headquarters in Denver. Neither Salem nor Stanbury. But Clarence O. Dodd and Andrew N. Duggar wrote a book in 1936 that was titled A History of the True Religion, traced from 33 AD to date. And this was the first serious effort to record the history of the Church of God from the time of the apostles all the way up to modern time. It was a very interesting book. I have a copy of it. There aren't a lot of copies available these days, but you can actually find it. The book has been criticized over the years, and fair enough. Some of the scholarship wasn't the best. It's as though if you knew a Sabbath keeper, you suddenly were declared to be a Sabbath keeper. The book talks about some of the founding fathers, like Benjamin Franklin and others, as being Sabbath keepers. Well, the truth is they were not, but they knew Sabbath keepers. They were friends with Sabbath keepers. But that doesn't make you a Sabbath keeper, you see. So there has been some criticism of the book. The first booklet in the Radio Church of God appeared in 1959, and it was titled The True History of the True Church. Some of you may actually even have copies of that. You can find copies even today. The Radio Church of God also had a 58-lesson Ambassador College Correspondence Course that had seven lessons covering the seven stages or eras of the church down through the last 2,000 years. It was based upon Revelation 2 and 3, the seven churches. Then there was a series of articles in the 1990s that appeared in the Plain Truth magazine. I actually wrote part 10 of that series in October of 1991. The title of the part that I wrote was The Sabbath Comes to New England. And what you'll see today, of course, would be a part of that. But not a lot in the last 30 years has been written by the church on the subject of church history. I think we all understand that the history of the true Church of God has been sort of clouded, and that when you read about church history, you're not talking about the true church. You know, you're talking about the Catholic Church as it developed over the years. It really requires a lot more work to find or locate the true church back through the years, especially when you get into the Middle Ages. It's very, very difficult. Last year, Church of God, a worldwide association, published our own booklet titled, Where is the Church That Jesus Built? And chapter 4 is titled, God's Church Through the Ages. It also takes a look at Revelation 2 and 3 and then gives a general overview of the church down through the last 2,000 years. So if you look at our history and you look at the writings of the church, we've said very little, we've written very little in the past 30 years on the subject. Why? Well, again, there are probably various reasons. I don't know that there's a single reason, but it's a difficult subject. It's a very difficult subject to nail down and be dogmatic about. My purpose today is to cover just a slice of that history, a slice of the history that I was personally involved in. Some of the things you'll see today are no longer possible to be seen. They only exist in my collection. I have over 600 slides that I collected in my research over the years, and a good portion of those are irreplaceable, and the places no longer exist. I've loaned my slides to other Church of God organizations. They've used them on their television programs. They've used them in articles because, as I said, it can't be reproduced. And what I'll show you today is a part of that and only a part of it. But I want to help establish what I see, and I hope you will see and understand, is a consistent thread of the Church of God, the people of God, from the day of Pentecost in 31 AD to our day today. We do have a heritage. We do have a connection. Hebrews chapter 11 describes those who went before the New Testament church, you know, the faithful, and what they endured in the past. What I'll present to you today is a part, only a part, of those that went before us. But I think it's every bit as powerful as Hebrews 11 when you understand what went before us, the people that went before us, our heritage as the Church of God. Now, I want to begin in the book of Revelation. Let's go to Revelation chapter 1. Revelation is probably the most unusual book in the Bible. It's the most mysterious book in the Bible. It was written by John the Apostle, and when you look at John's other writings, the book of John, the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, you discover that Revelation is completely different, completely different. It's an interesting book, and it provides an outline in prophecy. It is a prophetic book. It's not like the Gospel of John or the three books that John wrote, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. It's very different. Within the book of Revelation, there is a message to seven churches. Now, we have to take things at face value in the Bible. We have to assume and believe that these were messages to seven churches. That's what it says. But why these seven churches? Why? Why not Thessalonica? Could they have not profited from John's writings? Why not Corinth? Why not Philippi? Why not some of these other churches? By the time John writes at the end of the first century, there are dozens of churches. Why these seven churches? Well, we don't know absolutely for sure, but these seven churches were on a mail route that went from Ephesus, traveled through all of the other churches in order as they're presented in Revelation, and the last one on the mail route was Laodicea. So there seems to be some significance of these seven churches and them being in order of a mail route. It's sort of a circular mail route starting here at Ephesus and going up and around to Laodicea in the order that the messages are presented. So there seems to be something important about that. But let's look at Revelation chapter 1 in verse 1 and set the stage for these messages that are going to go out. It says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants things which must shortly take place. Now, in the margin, shortly doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to happen soon. It means that when it does happen, it'll happen quickly. In fact, the margin uses the word quickly. So, you know, reveal the things that are going to happen, and when they happen, they will happen quickly. So a lot of the book of Revelation is still yet to be fulfilled. And when it does begin to be fulfilled, the scripture says it'll happen so quickly that people will be taken by surprise. So we should expect that in the book of Revelation. And, of course, the message it says is sent to him by the angel of his servant John is presented. And then notice verse 3. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy. So everything we see in the book of Revelation should be taken from the perspective of prophecy. So does that mean even the seven messages to the churches has a prophetic aspect? Well, we should expect that. This is a prophecy. Blessed is he that follows, hears the words of this prophecy, and keeps those things which are written in it, for the time is near. Again, it's prophetic. Then notice verse 4. And John writes to whom? The seven churches which are in Asia. Seven churches that are in Asia are the recipients of this message. Again, why these seven? Why these seven churches? Notice verse 10 says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice as of a trumpet. So John is in the Spirit. You know, again, we're not talking about Sunday, the Lord's Day, as some want to read into it. It's a future time called the Day of the Lord, or the Lord's Day. So John is transported in vision to that day. Again, keep in mind, the message to the seven churches is in this context. And then verse 19 says, write the things which you have seen, and the things which are, and the things which will take place after this. So there are three things John is told to do. Acknowledge what you've seen in vision, things which are the reality of even the day he lived in, and then the things which will take place after this. Very important messages provided in the book of Revelation for the future. And then we read of seven churches and a message to each one. The New King James Version of the Bible has titles or headings throughout the scripture. Sometimes they're helpful, sometimes they're not. But I find it interesting that the New King James Version has a title over each one of these churches. For example, before the message to Ephesus, it says the loveless church, the church that lost its first love. There are only two of these churches that escape any criticism, and that's the church in Smyrna and the church in Philadelphia. And the church in Smyrna is called the persecuted church. The church in Pergamos is called the compromising church. And then the church in Thyatira is called the corrupt church. And then, of course, the Sardis church is called the dead church. And Philadelphia is called the faithful church. And Laodicea, beginning in verse 14 of chapter 3, is called the lukewarm church. It is our view, continues to be our view, that these seven churches are prophetic. And the message is prophetic. It describes the church over the next however many years until Christ returns. This fills the gap from the founding of the church on the day of Pentecost until the return of Jesus Christ. And it describes characteristics of the church down through these periods of time. These are truly messages to the seven churches. They were for them, and they're messages for the church of all time. To describe some of the pitfalls, some of the difficulties the church will face in the next 2,000 years approximately of history. We also find something interesting. The last three churches, That is Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea, appear to all exist at the same time. Now, why do I say that? Look at verse 3 of Revelation 3. The warning to Sardis. Be watchful and strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die, for I have not found your works perfect. That's actually verse 2. Verse 3. Remember, therefore, how you have received and heard. Hold fast and repent. Therefore, if you will not watch, I will come upon you as a thief. So the church in Sardis is warned to be ready, because if you're not ready, Christ will come upon you as a thief. So this is clearly in time. Clearly in time when Christ will come as a thief, we're told. Then look at verse 11, referring to Philadelphia. Behold, I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. So that's again in time. And then look at Laodicea in verse 20. He says, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him and he with me. So you have the last three churches on this mail route that occur or fill in the end time. Or as we would look at them, they overlap. And they're all three going to be in existence. Or all three characteristics will be in existence in the end time. If you think about it, you can see that all three of these characteristics exist today. There are those that are part of the church of God that are called dead. You know, they're spiritually dead. They have no real enthusiasm, you might say. They have no push for what the church stands for, what we believe. They're just sort of nominally called, you know, church of God or Christians. Philadelphia are faithful. So there will be those who will be faithful. You know, Christ asked the question, when I return, will the Son of Man find faith on the earth? And of course, he doesn't answer that. But the point is, well, yes, he will. There will be those who will be faithful. We find that. And then, of course, the Laodicea, those that are lukewarm. So we have those that are dead, those that are faithful, and those that are lukewarm. We should not look upon these three as necessarily organizationally, but a description of the people of God, the true church of God in the end time. Those that are dead, those that are faithful, and those that are lukewarm. We obviously want to be among the faithful, but we have a lot to do in order to do that as we look forward to the return of Jesus Christ. Now, we're not the only ones that view these seven churches as describing the story of the church over the next 2,000 years, and that it's prophetic, and that we have various, we've referred to them as eras or epochs or stages of the church. It's hard to call them eras, not that that's wrong, but it's hard because there's no definite date. You can say, well, this one begins, you know, in this year, and this one ends in this year. Especially when you get to the last three that all exist right up until the return of Jesus Christ. So they occupy time-wise the same era. You see, if you follow what I'm saying regarding that. But it is the story of the church. You have Ephesus was the apostolic church coming up to the first century. Then you have Smyrna that goes probably into the second or third century. Then you have Thyatira that comes into the Middle Ages and the things that happened to the church during that period of time. Then, of course, you have Sardis that picks up around 1500. And then, of course, you have Philadelphia. Then, of course, you have Laodicea. Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea, all occupying a part of the end time and all overlapping in that sense. Let me give you a quote, just as I said, just to confirm that there are others that see this way. This is not some odd interpretation of prophecy. This is from an author by the name of John F. Woolford. And Mr. Woolford wrote a commentary that is titled The Revelation of Jesus Christ. And he says this about Revelation 2 and 3. It says, many believe that in addition to the obvious implication of these messages, the seven churches represent the chronological development of church history viewed spiritually. They note that Ephesus seems to be characteristic of the apostolic period in general, and that the progression of evil climaxing in Laodicea seems to indicate the final state of apostasy of the church. The order of the messages to the churches seems to be divinely selected to give prophetically the main movement of church history. So again, it's not something that others don't see as well. This is not, as I said, unique to the church. But it is our belief and has been our belief. And again, you see some of the overlap as you get toward the end time. So that's the basis that we look at for our approach toward church history. From that perspective, I want to take you to the 1980s and my own personal experience in what you're going to see today through the slides. Early in the 1980s, I received a phone call. I was a pastor in the Worldwide Church of God, living in New England. My wife was from Georgia. I'm from Arkansas. I graduated from Ambassador College in Big Sandy. I was first serving in Atlanta. My first congregation to pastor was in Athens, Georgia. I had never been north. And the when I was transferred, I received the phone call saying we were moving to New England. And I remember telling my family about that, my grandmother, who was still alive in Arkansas, and I told her, I don't think she had been out of Arkansas since, you know, her entire life. That was a big deal for her to ever leave the state. And when I said, well, we're moving to Massachusetts, she says, where on earth is that? She said, is that a communist country? And I found out later she was probably correct. It was probably pretty close when you get up into the liberal aspects of the Northeast. But we'd never, you know, never dreamed that we would actually serve in that particular area. But it was an exciting place for us to be, and we were very happy to be there. But in those years, a feast film was done every year at the Worldwide Church of God at the feast sites. You may or may not remember that there was a series of programs that were done on the seven churches of Revelation. And if you remember, they had a runner passing the baton to one and passing the baton to the next one. Well, I received a phone call asking me, because I lived in the area where Newport, Rhode Island was, and where the first Sabbath keepers in America lived, if I could find out certain information. They would send out a film crew, I would scout out these areas, and I would learn some of the things about the Sabbath keepers. Because in spite of the fact that we taught it at Ambassador College, we had very little knowledge of this group of people. We had very little information, just that they existed. That was about it. So for the next several years, until we moved away from New England in 1987, I spent as much time as I could researching this particular group of people. Some of the material did appear in the feast film. Other material has appeared in other productions over the years done by various churches of God. I was happy and excited to be the one to be able to do that and provide the information. And along the way, I collected my own collection of books and things that I found there. I discovered that the Harvard University was founded for the purpose of educating religious education in America. That's in the charter of Harvard. You wouldn't know it today. 1636, Harvard was founded. I studied their charter, and in their charter it says, because they were a religious institution, that they provided free library rights to any minister who lived within 40 miles of Boston. It's a true story. You pull out of our driveway, there's a sign that said Boston, 39 miles. So I went to the Harvard Library and I said, this is where I live. Is this still true today? She said, absolutely. Here's your library card. You have full access to all of Harvard's libraries, which provided tremendous research material. Brown University was founded by Sabbath keepers. It's a premier Ivy League school. Most don't even know that. And they provided me with access to material at that time that's no longer available to the public. Other places, the Newport Historical Society opened their archives to me. I roamed around in their vaults where they kept things. The material is no longer available. And recorded and kept track of this and located the places that we wanted to film for the Behind the Work film at that time. And I was excited to do that. One disclaimer that I want to give before we actually begin the slide program is that I am not claiming, nor should anyone claim, that all of these individuals were part of the true Church of God. We know this, that the Church of God is going to be among the Sabbath keepers, that the Sabbath is an important sign of God's people. But every Sabbath keeper is not a member of the true church. Any more today than it was, you know, several hundred years ago. So that's my disclaimer. Look at 2 Timothy chapter 2. I feel I'm on good grounds by making this particular statement. The Apostle Paul writes in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 19. He writes this. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 19. He says, "Nevertheless, the solid foundation of God stands, having this seal. The Lord knows those who are his, and let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity." So God knows the ones that are truly a part of the church, the true church of God, and those who aren't. So as you see what I offer today, do not assume that I believe every one of these individuals, because they were Sabbath keepers, were a part of the true church. But I'm convicted that the true church is among these people. Those who were faithful to God's way of life are among these people. We identify them because of the Sabbath. And, of course, there are other things that we look for as well, but obviously the Sabbath is very important. Turn with me to Matthew chapter 16, verse 18. This is a very important prophecy that actually guides our discussion from this point forward. Matthew 16, verse 18. Matthew 16, verse 18. Of course, this is the famous example where Christ is looking at Peter. He says, "And I also say to you that you are Peter." You know, we read words in Scripture, and they're words. I think we all understand that when people communicate, a lot of their communication is their facial expressions, their hand gestures. We get none of that from reading Scripture. So, and I have read this in commentaries as well, but if you bear with me, I believe that Jesus Christ is looking at Peter, and he points to Peter, and he says, "I also say to you that you are Peter. You are Peter. And on this rock," he points back to himself, "I will build my church." You know, you're Peter. Peter was called Cephas, which is a stone. You're a pebble. And on this rock, I will build my church. And I believe that's, you know, if we were there seeing this, I think that's what we would see. Then he goes on to say, "And the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." So Christ prophesies that when the church is founded, it will never die. It will never die. We have the expectation that any year you want to pick, from 31 AD to 2019, you will find the church somewhere existing. The challenge is where, not whether it exists or not. So our challenge in church history is to identify where the true church is at any particular period of time. Well, and Hades simply means the grave, so it won't die. It'll never be buried. It may be small. It may be unnoticed. It may be under the radar of everyone around, but it will not die. So that's our challenge, finding the church. What about in the Middle Ages, when the Roman Catholic Church ran roughshod over anyone that rebelled against it, anyone that was not within the Catholic Church? They killed people. 32,000 people were killed for being a heretic in Spain in 1 year. 32,000 people recorded during the Spanish Inquisition. Within the Catholic Church, they had what they called Inquisition committees. And these were separate organizations that their exclusive responsibility was to seek out heretics and destroy them. Either they confess their heresy and change, or they are killed. The Sabbatarians, the Jews, and the Muslims were primary targets during those years. And thousands were burned and boiled in oil, drowned and ripped apart and beheaded during that period of time. All of the records that would identify the church were destroyed. A part of the heresy was that they destroyed all of your written works. So the Middle Ages is a very dark period of time for a variety of reasons. Finding the true church during that period of time is very difficult. And the only way you can find them, really, is to read what the Catholic Church wrote about them. It'd be like today, finding the worst enemies of the church and say, "Okay, you write a history about us." And that's what we have. Now, we can ferret out certain things about them, but it's very difficult to find out definitively how they believed and what they did. That's a challenge. But in studying church history, in tracking the history of the church, there's something we want to do. And Hebrews chapter 4 identifies this for us. Hebrews chapter 4 is, of course, the reference to the Sabbath. The Greek word sabbatismos is used in Hebrews chapter 4, and it identifies a keeping of the Sabbath remains for the people of God. So we look for, you know, not only the Old Testament refers to the Sabbath as being a sign of God's people. Please listen, it's a sign of God's people. It's not the only sign of God's people. Therefore, every Sabbath keeper is not a part of the church of God. Never has been. But the church of God has always been Sabbath keeping. You're not going to find the church of God among Sunday keepers. But not every Sabbath keeper is going to be a part of the true church. So rather, because we don't have enough information to be able to identify definitively, what I present today is following the path of the Sabbath from Europe to England to America. And I'm confident the true church of God is among those people. So just to be very, very clear. Look at this verse in different translations. I think you'll find it'll be interesting. First of all, this is the King James translation. There remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God. There remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God. The American Standard Version, though, says this. There remaineth therefore a Sabbath rest for the people of God. And then the Bible in basic English says, so that there is still a Sabbath keeping for the people of God. This is a New Testament scripture that describes who the people of God are. They are Sabbath keepers. So any study of the history of the church involves following the trail of the Sabbath. And that's what you'll see here today. We pick up the story of the Sabbath keepers in France. I'm going to pick up the story in the 12th century. In the 12th century, there are a group of individuals located in the south of France near the area of Lyon that are Sabbath keepers. They are highly persecuted. They are killed. They are searched out by the Catholic Church. They send armies into this area. It's in the area of Lyon, in the mountains, the Alpine mountains in southern France. Now, there is some dispute as to who these people really were. They're called historically Waldenses, Waldensians, Valdensians, and in some times they're called Passaginians. In some places they're called Cathari. There are various names that they have. And there are various ideas as to how they received their names. There was a famous Catholic priest by the name of Peter Waldo, who lived in this area. He departed from the Catholic Church because of the corruption, and he began a group that became known as Waldensians after Peter Waldo. But not all the Waldensians were followers of Peter Waldo. We confirm that historically. There is a group today called Waldensians, and I actually have a letter from this group today, and they will contend that they were always Sunday keepers. They were never Sabbath keepers, and that may be true of this particular group. But it is also true that there were a group of those who were called Waldensians who were Sabbath keepers, and we have historical records of that. Here are a couple of, this is from what's called Truth, a book called Truth and Triumph, The Church in the Wilderness by Benjamin George Wilkinson. He says this, in like manner, the noble and voluminous literature of the Waldenses, whether of the Italian, French, or Spanish branches, was almost completely obliterated by the rage of the papacy. Only fragments remain. We don't have a lot of historical firsthand data for these individuals. We have some, but not a lot. Robert Robinson writes this, that the people living in the valleys in different countries, known as the Valley Dwellers, or Valences. In fact, this author states his belief that the inhabitants of the Pyrenees were the true original Waldenses. The original word is the Latin valis. From it comes valleys in English, Valdisi in Italian, and Vaudois in French, and Valdenses in Spanish. So it isn't necessarily true, although it's possible, that the name of this group of people did not come from Peter Waldo, but came from the name of the valleys. And therefore, we identify them as being Sabbath keepers. Peter Alex, who was a historian, wrote this. He lays it down also as one of their opinions that the law of Moses, this is of these people, is to be kept according to the letter, and that the keeping of the Sabbath, circumcision, and other legal observances ought to take place. Now, he goes on to say, however, the accusation that they practice circumcision has been repeatedly proven to be false. And they're called Passaginians as well. So the group that was here had various names. This is from another book called The Waldenses Kept the Sabbath. It says, a commissioner of Charles XII of France reported that he found among them none of the ceremonies, images, or signs of the Roman Catholic Church, much less the crimes with which they were charged. On the contrary, they kept the Sabbath day, observed the ordinance of baptism according to the primitive church, and instructed their children in the articles of the Christian faith and commandments of God. And then one more historian, a fellow by the name of Goldast, he says the terms sabbati and sabbata and in sabbati refer to those who were keeping the seventh-day Sabbath in this area. So they were called Waldenses, they were called Valdenses, they were called sabbati and in sabbati. They were, at least portions of them, were Sabbath keepers in this area. And they were severely persecuted and attacked by the Roman church. And you'll find even in the Catholic Encyclopedia under the term Waldenses or the title Waldenses that to claim that Peter Waldo was the beginning of this entire group is simply not correct, that there was a broad name, and yes, Peter Waldo was associated with it. So they kept the Sabbath, but they were persecuted. The church was after them, trying to destroy them. So where will they go? One thing you'll find out about the history of the church, whenever there's intense persecution in one area, the church disappears and pops up somewhere else. It's as though God opens a door for them where they can go and continue observing the Sabbath. And that's what happens here. Somehow, we don't know how, the Sabbath keepers in southern France begin the trek across France and end up in Great Britain. Why would they go there? Because if you know your history, in the 1500s, Britain went from being Catholic to being Protestant, then back to Catholic, and then Protestant. When they became Protestant, when Henry VIII declared, he excommunicated the Pope, and the Pope excommunicated him. And Henry became, or developed the Church of England and himself as the head. So now they were open to Protestantism. And so now there was a wedge and an opportunity for the Sabbath keepers to flock into Britain, and they began to travel to Britain. So that comes to the 1500s. So for about 400 years, the Sabbatarians in southern France were persecuted, they were killed, they were sought down, run down by the armies of the Pope, and so then they flee to where they could go and practice the Sabbath, and that we find is in, for some reason I'm not clicking here, oh, there we go. So they end up in Britain, and this is an old magazine that was done by the Church of God in the 1800s. It's called the Sabbath Recorder, the Sabbath Recorder. And they had some historical articles that appeared in the Sabbath Recorder. The Sabbath Recorder became the Hope of Israel, or actually it's the other way around. The Hope of Israel became the Sabbath Recorder. The Sabbath Recorder became what is today the Bible Advocate for the Church of God Seventh Day. And this is an article that appeared in June of 1868. And the article says this: in 1552, many in England were known as Sabbatarians. So we have them in southern France. They disappear in southern France. Catholicism takes over, and now they appear in England. The Sabbath keepers have fled from Europe and now come to England, which is now, in the 1500s, a Protestant country, no longer dominated by the Catholic Church. So this is an article that appeared in June of 1868, when the article actually appeared. This publication goes back to 1852 and continues today as the Bible Advocate. It's the same publication. So here's what we find, though, that in about 1600, we find that there are 11 Sabbath-keeping churches in England, 11 Sabbath-keeping churches in England, and they're growing rapidly. In fact, we also have evidence when I was interviewing longtime church members and Sabbatarian families in Rhode Island, every time I'd go somewhere, they'd give me a stack of books that they would have, and they wanted me to have them. And these would be old books and historical books, rare books you could find nowhere else. And in those books, you discovered that not only did they keep the Sabbath, at least one of these congregations also kept the days of unleavened bread. They all kept the Passover. And we have at least one of them kept the days of unleavened bread, as it is recorded of them. But so now they populate the area of London, and 11 churches in that small area, and they're growing. because they have a place where they can grow, because England is now Protestant. They're no longer running from the Catholic Church. And they begin to see some growth in that particular area. But something's going to happen here. It isn't going to be long-lived that they will be allowed to, that they're tolerated. Something's going to happen. So now where will they go? Well, at the same time this is going on, in the early 1600s, another event is taking place that's going to have important ramifications for the Sabbath keepers. In the New World, which is, of course, the next frontier, there's a fellow by the name of Roger Williams. This is a statue of Roger Williams that stands just outside the city of Providence, Rhode Island. This is actually not the statue that stands there, but this is another statue of Roger Williams. No one knew exactly what Roger Williams looked like. So they're saying that this statue was modeled after Ted Williams, the baseball player. And I don't know if you can tell that, but his last name was Williams, so they took his face and they created the statue of Roger Williams because nobody knew what he looked like. There was no picture, there was nothing they had, no painting of Roger Williams. But he's a very important individual. He was born in Britain in 1603. He died in New England in 1683. He arrived in Boston in 1630, seeking religious freedom. Now, he was a Puritan, at least initially. But Roger Williams was a very strange individual. He was run out of every church he ever pastored. They eventually ran him out of town because he had some strange ideas. He arrived in Boston in 1630. He pastored a church in Salem, Massachusetts. They put up with him for a couple of years, and they literally ran him out of town, forced him to leave town because of his beliefs. And he goes down to Plymouth, and he starts a church there, and pretty soon they run him out of town. So where will he go? Well, he crosses the river into an unknown area, an uncharted area, purchased a small segment of the area from the Indians, and established the first settlement in what became the colony of Rhode Island. But Roger Williams was so distraught that everywhere he went, no one allowed him to practice what he believed. And so he determined that in this new colony, there would be religious freedom. Because guess what? There was no religious freedom, in spite of what you may believe, in the other colonies. In fact, if you were a Baptist in Massachusetts, you could be put in prison. If they caught you baptizing by immersion, you could be put in prison. If you were a Quaker, you were put in prison. They tolerated nothing. Roger Williams said, that's not right. So he wrote a charter, and Rhode Island became a chartered colony of Great Britain. And in his charter, he wrote this. This is the first place in the world in which religious freedom was guaranteed. It wasn't in Europe. It wasn't in any other part of the world. The first place was Rhode Island. That actually put it in their founding documents. This is what it says. It says, now know you that we, being willing to encourage the hopeful, see if I can read it here, and to encourage the hopeful undertakings, and to secure them in the free exercise and enjoyment of all the civil and religious rights appertaining to them. No person shall hereafter be molested, punished, disquieted, or called in question for any difference in opinion in matters of religion who do not disturb the civil peace. He put this in the charter. The charter was granted by King Charles, and now we have Rhode Island, one of the smallest colonies that now guarantees religious freedom. Something is now happening back in England that's going to make this very, very important. Not at the time, but later on. This is 1636. There's a national park in Providence, Rhode Island today, and this is a replica of Roger Williams' home. It's not his home, but it's a replica of his home in Providence, Rhode Island. So he was a very wealthy man. He became quite a merchant. He became what he called a seeker of truth. And he tolerated not only the Sabbath keepers, but he tolerated the Quakers and the Baptists. So Rhode Island became a haven for the Baptists, the Quakers, and the Sabbath keepers. It's all going to begin very, very shortly. Roger Williams is considered the founder of the First Baptist Church in America. This is the Baptist Church, the First Baptist Church in Providence, Rhode Island, which was founded by Roger Williams. This building was built in the 1800s, but this is the location of the First Baptist Church in Rhode Island, and also the First Baptist Church in America. The Baptists were not welcomed by the Puritans. The Quakers were not welcomed by the Puritans in New England, and they persecuted them greatly. Notice the sign out front of this Baptist church. Notice it was founded in 1638. Remember, Roger Williams came in 1630. He was run out of Salem. He was run out of Plymouth. He settles in 1636, and 2 years later, he, along with a few others, founded the First Baptist Church in America. I'm going to show you later on there's a dispute as to which is the First Baptist Church in America, because you're going to see that in Newport, Rhode Island, there was a Baptist church founded at the same time by John Clark. So the question is, did Clark found the First Baptist Church or did Roger Williams? Historically, we find it's Roger Williams. But the Baptists are upset with Roger Williams because guess what? They ran him off as well within a year. So he founded the Baptist church and they run him off. And he has no church. And for the rest of his life, he called himself a seeker of truth, and he never joined another organization from that point on. But he had many friends who were Sabbath keepers. At Roger Williams College in Rhode Island, all of Roger Williams' letters are there. And in one of his letters, he writes to Samuel Hubbard, who was a Sabbath keeper. And in his letter, he says, "You almost convinced me to keep the Sabbath and the festivals," he writes. But he said, "Colossians 2 does it for me, and I don't think we need to be keeping the Sabbath or these festivals." Which also tells us that there were some who were also keeping the festivals among the Sabbath keepers. But Roger Williams provided a haven where people who were being persecuted could come. Remember, again, we're going to go back to England and see what's happening there. Here's how bad it was in Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, or in Boston, there is the Boston Common, which is the oldest public park in America. On the Boston Common, if you walk around, there are a lot of plaques to historical events, a lot of things in the park. Here's a plaque that's in the park. It's like a granite slab in which this is written. "Mary Dyer, Quaker, witness for religious freedom, hanged in Boston Common, 1660. Keep these dates in mind. This is what was happening in Massachusetts. If you were a Quaker, you could be hanged. If you were a Baptist, you were put in prison. When you fly into Boston today, the airport in Boston is in the harbor. It's actually kind of on an island out in the harbor. And you're flying into Boston, you'll fly over a couple of little islands. One of them is called Noodles Island. Noodles Island has the remains of a prison that was there. The Baptists were imprisoned on Noodles Island. And the Puritans were so angry with them, they would imprison them on Noodles Island and not feed them at all. They starved to death. And they stayed on the island till they died. You see that island as you fly into Boston. The Puritans were not tolerant at all. And there was a lot of persecution, especially if you were a Quaker or if you were a Baptist, you were persecuted. Now let's go back to England. What's happening in England at this same time? Well, Great Britain has now become, they become Protestant for sure. They did go back to Catholicism, I think it was under Mary, and then they went back to Protestantism again. But there was a lot going on religiously. Here is a reproduction of a booklet. It was very popular in the late 1500s and through the 1600s that whenever there was a historical event, they would write a little booklet or publish a little pamphlet about it. And I've seen dozens, if not hundreds, of these little pamphlets about various events. There is one about this particular event. It's the story of John James. Now, who was John James? John James was the pastor of the Sabbatarian Church north of London in White's Castle is where it was located. And he was the pastor. It's recorded on this particular date. It was November the 26th, 1661. Again, keep in mind these dates. He was preaching away one Sabbath when the king's guard rushed in, dragged him from the pulpit, took him across the street, charged him with rebellion against the government, insurrection. They tried him, they convicted him, and then they sentence him to be hanged. Now, why would they do that to a Sabbatarian minister? The British Empire took great umbrage with anyone who claimed that there was another empire coming. There was a political group in England at the time who were called the Fifth Monarchist. Now, where does the term Fifth Monarchist come from? These were individuals that believed that there was another monarchy coming that was going to rule the world, and it wasn't going to be Britain. They felt that Daniel chapter 2 described that fifth empire. There were four world-ruling empires, and the fifth one is the stone cut out without hands that strikes the image on its feet. They interpreted that fifth empire as being one that's coming. They didn't always look at it as though the return of Christ, but it's a kingdom that's going to come and is going to destroy Britain. And so they became a big political movement. Now, John James wasn't involved in that movement, but he did believe there was another empire coming, Jesus Christ. And the British didn't like that. And so he was charged with insurrection. And he was convicted, he was hanged, and his body torn in four parts. They tied horses, one horse to his one arm, one horse to another arm, one horse to a leg, and one horse to another leg, and sent them galloping in all four directions, ripped his body apart. They then took his head and put it in front of the church on a pole to prevent anybody from coming back and worshiping in that place again. John James, this was happening not just to John James, but all the Sabbath keepers in that area were being persecuted now. Whereas they'd been able to thrive before, they now had to go underground. Intense persecution drove the Sabbath keepers to a new land. Remember, there's a land that's been prepared, the colony of Rhode Island, where religious freedom is guaranteed. So where are they going now? They can't go back to Europe. Where will they go? We now find that they're going to come to the new world. But not just the new world. They're going to come to the one place in the new world where they could practice keeping the Sabbath and worship without harm. And so they're going to end up in Rhode Island, the tiniest colony, the one that, just simply very small. Rhode Island consisted as a colony and as a state today, and it's the mainland and it's a series of islands. Newport, Rhode Island is on an island. And then you have provinces on the mainland. Because these were two distinct parts to the colony. They alternated the governorship. One term the governor would come from Providence, and the next term the governor would come from Newport. And they alternated when it became a colony. But religious freedom was guaranteed. So we have the first Sabbath keeper coming to Newport, arriving in Newport in 1664. 3 years after the execution of John James. The Sabbath keeper was not a member of John James' congregation, but he was a member of one of the 11 Sabbath-keeping congregations. And he arrives in Rhode Island. Probably my favorite place in the world, literally, to visit is Newport, Rhode Island. They've maintained the old colonial look to it. It's like a colonial village still today at the harbor. In 1664, it was less than 1,000 people, but it was a haven for the Quakers, the Baptists, and now the Sabbath keepers. Stephen Mumford and his family arrive in Newport. This is the shoreline in Newport, Rhode Island. It was the playground for the rich. These are all homes of people like the Astors and the Rothschilds, and especially out of New York City, they would build these summer homes in Newport. And this is Ocean Drive in Newport, Rhode Island. As pretty a drive as I've seen anywhere in the United States. This is where Stephen Mumford, his wife Anne, and their children, Stephen and Anne Mumford, arrive. Because you wanted to carry on the family name, you often had children named exactly, they weren't called Junior, they were exactly the same as the parents, which makes it difficult in your study sometime. So Stephen and Ann Mumford had two children, Stephen and Ann Mumford. And they arrive in Newport, Rhode Island in 1664. Others came about that time as well. For example, the Quakers. Remember Mary Dyer, 1660, was hanged on Boston Common? So now the Quakers show up. This is the oldest Quaker meeting house in America, built in 1699. That's been added on to, but this is part of this is the original building. This would be the original building back here, and this has been added on. So the Quakers show up. The Baptists show up, and they begin to establish churches in Rhode Island where they could have freedom. And then, of course, the Sabbath keepers show up as well. This is the oldest tavern in America, and it's called the White Horse Tavern. It was established in 1673. It still operates today. This was important because this was only about 3 blocks from where Stephen Mumford ended up living. It's also only a block away from where the meeting hall was that the Sabbatarians eventually used. The name of this street here is called Farewell Street. Guess why it was called Farewell Street? At the end is the cemetery. And it's called Farewell as you come down and you're about to be buried in the old colonial cemetery. And it sits right here. It was a famous tavern visited by many of the founding fathers of the United States. And the Sabbath keepers would gather there because, guess what? They were not teetotalers. They enjoyed a drink now and then, and they would come to the White Horse Tavern for that purpose. 1673, America's oldest tavern. So there's a lot in Newport. There's also the oldest public library in America is in Newport as well. It's called the Redwood Library. It's a statue of George Washington in front of the Redwood Library. But the Redwood Library was important because in this library, remember I said that a lot of firsthand information is unavailable. The old True History of the True Church quoted extensively from a book that was called Heresiography. It's written by the Catholics in the Middle Ages against the heretics. Hence, it's called Heresiography. It has a huge section on the Sabbath keepers there. The True History of the True Church quoted that book. The critics said, well, it doesn't exist. There is no such book as Heresiography. Somebody made it up, and then somebody quotes it, and somebody quotes it, and somebody quotes it. And that often happens. That's true. You'll find it among some of those who profess to be writing, of course, the story of the church. So I wondered, well, could it be possible that there's actually a copy here? And sure enough, we discovered, I don't know if there are any other copies, but there is a copy of the Heresiography in this library. And we were given access to it. And sure enough, it documents those in southern France were Sabbath keepers. Not only is the book here, it's a 5-volume work. And it's here at the Redwood Library. And we discovered it there. When people had said, many had said, it doesn't exist. It does exist. And it's located here in the Redwood Library. But it's such an old book, you can't actually have access to it today. We were allowed to at least see it. We were allowed to get quotes from it at that time. But I don't know, no more can you actually do that. Remember the Baptists. The Baptists showed up. Remember I showed you the First Baptist Church in Providence was 1638. But I said there's a dispute among the Baptists. It was the First Baptist Church in Newport, was also established in 1638 by John Clark. There's a battle going on as to who was actually first. Was it Roger Williams or was it John Clark? Now, this is going to play prominently in the story of the Sabbath keepers because Stephen Mumford is not a minister. He and his family are Sabbath keepers from a Sabbath-keeping church in London. And they show up. They don't have a church. They don't have a minister. So the family, Stephen Mumford and his family, begin attending the Baptist church. They keep the Sabbath at home on the Sabbath, and they go to the Baptist church on Sunday for the fellowship. You remember, this is a small community where they are. And the Baptists taught differently, though, at this time. They believed in what they call the Lord's Supper once a year, not quarterly. They believed that the kingdom of God would come to this earth. The millennium would be here on earth. They also believed in other things that the Baptists no longer accept or believe in. So Stephen Mumford felt somewhat comfortable fellowshipping with this group of people. This is the building that was obviously built in the 1800s, but this is the location of the First Baptist Church. This is just around the corner from the White Horse Tavern, and also from where we're going to identify the first meeting house. Now, one of the things that I was asked to do, a couple of things I was asked to do for the film that was done, is see if I could locate Stephen Mumford's home. He lived in Newport, we know that. He was a wealthy merchant, we know that. Where did he live? Does his home still exist? Remember, during the American Revolution, many of the homes in Newport were destroyed. The British took over and they destroyed many of the homes. But some did survive. So is it possible Stephen Mumford's home is still here? Because that would be where the first Sabbath keepers met in the New World. And we wanted to locate it. I began researching, looking for it. During the course of my research and study, I met a lady at the Newport Historical Society by the name of Mrs. Bullhouse. Mrs. Bullhouse was about 4 feet eight. She was a very, very nice lady, kind of loud and boisterous, and very friendly lady, and she handled the archives at the Newport Historical Society. So I made friends with her, and when I would come down to do my research, I would walk around the city, I would walk around the cemeteries, I'd go ask her for information. One day I told her, I said, I'm looking for Stephen Mumford's home. Do you have any idea? She said, well, I don't really know, but she said, you know, back in the vault, I think there is a will that says the will of Stephen Mumford. And maybe if we find his will, we could find his house. I said, that'd be great. So we have to come back with me. We have to go back in the vault. We got to wade through a lot of stuff that's back there and see if we can find it. And sure enough, we found a manila folder that said Stephen Mumford's will. Unfortunately, it was Stephen Mumford, the son's will. But guess what? He identified the house where his father lived. And he says it's so many rods from the harbor and in so many rods to the right, and that's where the house sat. So I said, okay, I'm going to see if I can find it. So I go to the harbor, and I start from the harbor, and I walk off the distance, and I take a right, and I walk off the distance, and I'm standing in front of this house. It's a museum. It's called the Wanton Lyman Hazard House. This is a picture from the 1920s of this house. It's been a museum for a long time. It's the oldest surviving house in Newport, Rhode Island. But it was called the Wanton Lyman Hazard House. So I went in and inquired. They said, no, it was built by the Wantons. They had no record of Stephen Mumford ever being in this house. One day I was looking around in the museum, and I saw a young student taking notes and looking around inside the building. And I went over, and he was a student from Brown University. He was working on his thesis that he was writing on this house. And I walked over, and I said, well, you know, I've studied this quite a bit. This is a couple of years into my research now. Or actually, not a couple of years, probably 6-7 months at that point. And I said, I believe this house was built by Stephen Mumford and belonged to him. And he said, so do I. I said, but how do we prove it? He said, well, they're going to allow me to take some soundings, or actually take some a drill into the beams here and do a test to see how old it is, because they had it dated in the 1700s, which would have been beyond Stephen Mumford. And so he said, I'm going to write it up. And I said, okay, we shared information, some things that I'd found. I told him about the will. And so he wrote his thesis, and his thesis was published. And he convinced the museum that it was actually built by Stephen Mumford for Stephen Mumford. And so now when you go to this museum today, they have a brochure that says that, based upon the thesis done by the student, that this was Stephen Mumford's home, built in 1697. Of course, this is what it says today. There was nothing of this when I first went. It says this today. Mumford was a merchant and a founding member of Newport's Seventh-day Baptist congregation. Now, keep in mind, they did not use the term Seventh-day Baptist until the 1800s. Historians are writing it backwards and calling these people Seventh-day Baptists. They call themselves the Church of God, or the Church of Jesus Christ, or just the Church. That's what they call themselves. They refused to publish an official name because it meant you had to be recognized by the state. They call themselves in their writings the Church, or the Church of God in their writings. They never use the term Seventh-day Baptist. That's a writing backwards and calling them that. So this house passed to Stephen Mumford's son. That's why it was in the will. Although there was no name on it in the will, but I walked it off and I was convinced this was the house. Stephen Mumford Jr., they call it. That really wasn't the name, but he was just Stephen Mumford. He sold it to Richard Ward, who sold it to others, and Ward's son Samuel was also a governor. Richard Ward and Samuel Ward were governors of Rhode Island. So this is the house built by Stephen Mumford, where the first Sabbath keepers gathered for services, was in this house. And this is a picture of the house today, the museum, as I said. It's a museum. They have on the side the hours. You go in this way. This is a kind of a side road, and in the will, it describes all of this so that, again, I was convinced that this was the right location. Now, one other thing I was asked to find was his grave. Could I find Stephen Mumford's grave? Now, you have to understand that certainly from this era of time, they would write a lot of history on the on their tombstones, on their gravestones. There's actually a study of graves. It's actually called Taphophile. A taphophile, it literally means in I think it's either Latin or Greek, it literally means a lover of graves. I became skilled at finding graves and identifying. I could identify a tombstone within 20 years by just looking at it and the style of it. There's really a science to it. But could I find his grave? Well, a lot of people during that time, especially if they were wealthy, would have themselves buried in their backyard. Well, this was a museum. They weren't letting me get to the backyard, but that wasn't going to stop me. So I head down this side road here, and there's a tall fence, probably 4 feet tall or higher, and I'm over the fence while no one is coming. I destroyed a few suits during this period of time, but I got into the backyard, and unfortunately, there was nothing there. And fortunately, I didn't get caught. But I had to find out if he was buried there, and sure enough, he wasn't. Where would he be buried? I go back to Mrs. Bullhouse, and she said, well, you know, the second oldest cemetery in America is the Colonial Cemetery here in Newport. I would bet he's buried there. But where would he be buried? Well, I said, okay, how big can a cemetery be? I'll just go and look. Well, this is a 200-and-some-odd-year-old cemetery. It is huge. It covers several acres. This is what I saw in the cemetery. Where do you start? I decided I would start over here and walk up and down every row. I did this for 3 days. I walked and walked and walked. I came back to Mrs. Bullhouse and I said, I can't find it. She said, well, you know, if you'll come with me back to the vault, she said, I think there's an old plat map that identifies where all the graves are. I said, let's go see if it's on that. And sure enough, she pulled out this old vellum plat map of the Colonial Cemetery, and sure enough, we found right here Stephen Mumford's grave. And it's just off the main road and just to the right. I was over here walking, 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 and never got here. But now I walked right to it and found his grave, hoping that there'd be something about the Sabbath on his tombstone. It's actually not there, but finding his grave was important, locating it. This is Stephen Mumford and his family. His wife is next to him. But now I had another dilemma. There are all these pagan symbols of this skull with wings and all of this. Why would they do that? Well, guess what? You don't put your own tombstone over your grave. And none of his family were ever in the church after he and his wife. And plus the fact I identified this headstone is not from the early 1700s. This is from the mid-1700s because of the shape. The style from the early 1700s is a single slab that's rectangular. So this was a later headstone put over his grave. Therefore, it explained the pagan symbols that were there. But this is his headstone. This is a little better picture of it. And this is what it says. Here lieth buried ye body of Stephen Mumford, aged 68 years, and departed this life July of 1707. First Sabbath keeper in America, he and his wife, this is where he's buried. And next to him is his wife, Anne. And again, you see the pagan symbols a little clearer. They put fruit and other things on the side in case you get hungry on your journey. You can take that with you. And then, of course, they have the skull with the wings coming out of it. You know, your soul is flying off to heaven. Obviously, again, this was put by family members much later over their tomb. And I'll show you why I know that for a fact. So this is Ann Mumford's. But here's an unusual part here. Here lieth buried ye body of Ann Mumford, ye wife of Stephen Mumford, age 63 years, deceased February 22nd, 1697/8. I don't even know what year it is. What's that all about? Well, there's a very important thing that takes place. The Gregorian calendar was adopted in the world in the 1500s, Pope Gregory. But British colonies did not adopt it until 1752. So every date in American history before 1752 is suspect. You have to know which calendar it is. The Julian calendar that was followed until 1752 in America begins its year on March the 25th, is New Year's on the Julian calendar. So this date of February is on the Julian calendar, is still 1697. But on the Gregorian calendar, it's now 1698. The Gregorian calendar wasn't adopted until 1752. This headstone was put here somewhere between 1720 and 1740, which is 20 to 40 years after their deaths. These headstones were placed. And that's why, of course, all the pagan symbols. Again, I'll show you a little close-up of this here on Anne Mumford's grave, 1697/8. Beginning about 1720, when they knew the change was coming, they began to list all the dates like this. So if it was January to March 25th, it would be 1 year on the old calendar and another year on the new calendar. So this was placed here between 1720 and 1752. Which was well after the death of Stephen and Anne Mumford. Now, I know this also for this. This is a tombstone or a gravestone of one of the original members of the Sabbatarian Church. Notice the difference. He carved his own headstone. Not only is it significant, this is one of the more famous headstones in America, and you'll find it in a lot of magazines because it was done by the individual who is buried here. That's a very rare thing. And here's what it says. This is Roger Baster. He was one of the original seven members. The first Sabbatarian Church began with seven members in Newport, Rhode Island. Here's, again, a closer-up view. This is what it says on it. Here lieth the body of Roger Baster, bachelor, blockmaker, age 66 years, died the 23rd day of April, 1687. He was one of the first beginners, not of the Seventh-day Baptist Church, but a Church of Christ observing of the seventh-day Sabbath of the Lord in New England. So this was so important to them, they put it on their headstone. Roger Baster was one of the original seven members of the church. He came from the First Baptist Church. The first seven members, as we'll see, were quite a group. They had every demographic of the church today. They had a bachelor, they had a lady that was married to an unconverted individual, and they had two couples among the seven. And then they had another individual who was married, as I said, to an unconverted individual who was never part of the church. So every demographic of the church down through the ages was involved in these seven members. And I'll show you that here in a moment. I go back to the Newport Historical Society. This is where it is. This is where their archives are. I had full access to a lot of their archives that no one can see anymore. They're all locked away. They're no longer available for anyone to use. I was able to use them, to photocopy them at my leisure. Here is there's a museum attached to the Historical Society. It's a small building that was attached. It was a wooden building that was bricked up to match the Historical Society. It was moved here from about two blocks away. This is the oldest Sabbatarian meeting house in America, and it's a museum now connected here. Now, this is not the oldest building. There was another building that preceded it, but it burned down. This building was actually built in 1729. After, of course, Stephen Mumford. And until then, as far as we know, they met in Stephen Mumford's home. This is the inside of the building. If you go back, let me go back a minute. You'll see the main entrance is located here. And this is the building. It has a loft area. And it has, of course, a seating area for services. But notice where the entrance is. Now, notice these two windows here. You'll see the plaque of the Ten Commandments is between these two windows. Now, there's something interesting about all of the Sabbatarian meeting locations. They built all of their buildings like this. So these are the two windows you saw from the outside. They have the Ten Commandments. The lectern is built into the wall. Very beautiful woodwork lectern. It's built into the wall. The minister walked up the steps and stood above the people. And, of course, there was a loft up here and the people down here. But this is the main entrance to the building. They did it deliberately. So if you came late for church, you had to walk by the minister. And it's recorded in their minutes, so-and-so was late for church and reprimanded by the pastor. So, and all of their buildings basically have this pattern where the entrance is next to the lectern. So when you walk in, you had to walk by the minister. This is the plaque that's there today identifying the original seven members. Now, again, it's referred to as Seventh-day Baptist, but that was not the name they used. Here are the seven members. William Hiscox, Stephen Mumford, Samuel Hubbard, Roger Baster, Sister Hubbard, Sister Mumford, and Sister Rachel Langworthy. So William Hiscox was married, but his wife was never a part of the church. Stephen Mumford and his wife Anne, of course, were. Samuel Hubbard and his wife Tacy Hubbard were. Roger Baster was single, and Rachel Langworthy was the daughter of the Hubbards, and also her husband was never a part of the church. The first seven members. And they started in 1671, old style. It was actually January the 4th, Gregorian calendar, 1672. Someone pointed out to me a few years ago that this is actually the date, December 23rd, that Church of God, a worldwide association, began. We began in Florida as an official organization December 23rd, 2010. I'm sorry, yeah, 2010. So again, obviously this is the old style Julian calendar. Every date in American history prior to 1752 is suspect, depending on which calendar you're using. There are 11 days difference between the two calendars. So that's why you see some of the dates. Some will just ignore this, and others will actually record it. So they began worshiping in Newport, Rhode Island, 1671. How did it all begin, though? Remember, they were attending the Baptist church. Stephen and Ann Mumford were attending the Baptist church, but people began to ask them about the Sabbath. And before you know it, there were 11 people meeting in the Mumford's home on the Sabbath from the First Baptist Church. Now, this isn't a large church. It's becoming a problem for the Baptist. And it became a serious problem for the Sabbath keepers because four members, because they felt pressured by the ministry, stopped keeping the Sabbath and went back to Sunday. Stephen and Ann Mumford had a problem. They wrote a letter back to England to Edward Stinnett, who was their pastor. And they said, "What do we do now?" You see, as long as these individuals didn't know the truth, they had no problem socializing with them. But now you had four people who knew the truth and then went back. What do we do now? And Stinnett wrote to them, he says, "You can no longer associate with those people because they knew the truth and they rejected it." So they, Stephen and Anne, stop attending the Baptist church. Now there are seven of them keeping the Sabbath, but five of them are still going to the Baptist church. This becomes a problem. One Sunday morning, Obadiah Holmes, the associate pastor of the First Baptist Church, gave a sermon entitled "Going Back to Moses." And he said, "There are some in this congregation that have gone back to Moses." He concludes his sermon by saying that how wrong that was. When the sermon was over, individuals stood up. Tacy Hubbard stood up and said, "Sir, are you talking about us?" To which Obadiah Holmes responded, "If the shoe fits, wear it." And then there was a big uproar. Now, this is all recorded in church minutes. And so Obadiah Holmes calmed everybody down. He said, "Okay, on Thursday night, John Clark will be back. He's the pastor. And he will talk to all of you." That Thursday night, the five of them lined up in front of John Clark. And he says, "Is this true? Do you believe in keeping the Sabbath on Saturday?" No one said a word. It's recorded in the minutes that after several minutes of silence, Tacy Hubbard spoke up again. She said, "Sir, we must obey God and not man. And we will continue to keep the Sabbath." To which there was another uproar. And the five of them had to leave the Baptist church. And then, of course, they linked up with Stephen and Ann Mumford and became the original seven members. These are the minutes from the church. These were available to me. They're no longer available. This in the middle is the oldest book of the minutes. It records a lot of things that went on. Everything that went on, they recorded. Every little thing. This is dated 1692. The original book from 1672 was burned in a fire. This is the oldest book of Sabbatarian meeting minutes. And then, of course, these other two books are different eras or years later. But this is the oldest. 1692. Here's the inside cover of the minutes, or of this book of minutes. And you'll see again, this is the original writing. And this is, it talks about these being the minutes of the church, of the Church of Christ keeping the Sabbath, of the Church of God. This is how they referred to themselves, 1692. Here's the list of members in 1707 now. List of members in 1707. On the left is an attempt to reproduce the list. On the right is the actual list from the 1707. These are the men and these are the women. There were 30 women and 12 men in the congregation. The women were a lot more dedicated, a lot more sincere about their religion than the men were, which we've seen in the church over the years as well. There's some interesting names. The only one of the original members still alive is Rachel Langworthy. This is her name here. But there's another interesting lady here called Free Love Barker. Who on earth would name your daughter Free Love Barker? Well, her name was Abigail Barker, and she was always in trouble with the church. And it's recorded in the minutes. Abigail Barker and her daughter Free Love Barker lived on Martha's Vineyard, and yet they were expected to be at church every Sabbath. There was a four-hour ferry ride plus a carriage to take them to church, and they were expected to be there every Sabbath. So if you weren't there, there would be a letter of reprimand written to you. Here's the actual letter of reprimand written to Abigail Barker in 29-30. Again, they began to use the slash because it was in March. This is what the letter says. This is the actual letter written to Abigail Barker. It's a letter of reprimand. If you didn't show up for services on the Sabbath, you get a letter of reprimand. If you missed two Sabbaths in a row, after the third Sabbath, all of the elders would show up at your house to know why you weren't at church for the last 3 weeks. Here's what this letter says. To Abigail Barker, mother of Free Love Barker, from our church meeting, March 15th, 1729-30. Whereas you were laid under admonition for your evil course of life and keeping bad company and drinking to excess and neglecting to attend God's public worship. So this is a letter of reprimand that was delivered to Abigail Barker. I don't know what the result was, but she shows up in several letters of the church minutes. She didn't get along real well with the ministry of the church back in those days. This is in the minutes. In addition to the original members of the church, there were some well-known Sabbatarians in Rhode Island. In fact, the Sabbatarian group became the dominant group in Rhode Island, and there were thousands of them shortly after the Revolutionary War. In fact, the largest church in America at that time was a Sabbath-keeping church in Rhode Island with over 2,000 members. They dominated southern Rhode Island. Now, here's the irony. Today, Rhode Island has no real, they have knowledge, but they have no real acknowledgement of that at all. No real acknowledgement of it at all. In fact, Rhode Island today is a 95% Catholic. The Italians and the Irish, they're all Catholic now. So when we moved to Massachusetts, I had a wedding to do in Rhode Island. And so in order to do a wedding, I had to go down and register with the state. So I walk into the state office. And this is underneath the state house in an office, and I go to, so I can do a wedding. I show them my certificate of ordination. She looks at it, she says, "What's this?" I said, "Well, it's my certificate of ordination." "Well, did you do that yourself?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, I never heard of your church." She says, "I'll tell you what, the only way you can do a wedding in Rhode Island is you have to get the Catholic priest, the bishop of the Catholic Church, to sign the document. That's the only way you can do a legal wedding in Rhode Island. And he's supposed to attend." And I said, "Well, I don't think that's going to work." I said, "Well, he doesn't attend. You give him $50 and he'll sign it." This is a state official telling me. "Give him $50 and he'll sign it and everything will be okay." The only way you could be married in the state of Rhode Island was it had to be authenticated by the Catholic Church. Unless you had a church meeting in Rhode Island, which we did have. I didn't know that. I finally got around to that because I didn't live in Rhode Island. But if your church meets in Rhode Island, then you can perform a wedding. But if you don't have a church meeting in Rhode Island and you live out of the state, the Catholic Church has to authenticate. The state of Rhode Island does not give marriage certificates. The Catholic Church gives the marriage certificates. Now, they'll give you a license, but they don't give you a certificate to get married. So from a haven for Sabbath keepers to a Catholic, oligarchy today in the state of Rhode Island is what you find. But there were several leading individuals. One, in fact, is a fellow by the name of Sam Ward. Sam Ward was a part of the Continental Congress. Now, you have to understand, the Sabbatarians were opposed to political involvement. So Sam Ward, while he attended the Sabbatarian church, there's no record of his baptism because he was involved in politics. He was the governor of Rhode Island, and he went to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia and would have been a signer of the Declaration of Independence, but he died of smallpox within a few months of the actual signing of the Declaration of Independence. He did sign in November of 1775 what's called the Document of Secrecy, which they all agreed to keep secret what they were doing until they finished the Declaration. This was in November of 1775. And you'll see, you know, John Hancock, all of the famous individuals that signed the Declaration have signed this. And Samuel Ward signed it as well. He had an unusual signature. He signed his name Sam:Ward. It's one of the most unusual signatures. But he signed this document, and he would have signed the Declaration of Independence, but he died in the spring of 1776 of smallpox, which spread through Philadelphia that year. But he was a governor. There was no baptismal record, but he attended the Sabbatarian Church. His father was also an attendee, but he was also a governor. And they're both buried in the same cemetery where I showed you before. This is Richard Ward's grave, and this is Samuel Ward's grave, father and son. Now, in Richard Ward's stone, it says his wife was a member of the Sabbatarian Church for 55 years. Richard Ward was never listed as a member. Again, they didn't like the fact that he was involved in politics, and he was never baptized, but he attended, and his wife was a member. So some of the famous members or attendees of the Sabbatarian Church. The Sabbatarian group or the Sabbatarians spread from eastern Rhode Island, from Newport, to an area called Westerly. Westerly became the largest group, largest church in America was in Hopkinton, Rhode Island, which is just outside of Westerly. 2,000 members. And they really congregated in that area. This is the Pawcatuck River that separates Connecticut from Rhode Island. And a lot of Sabbath keepers from Connecticut came over and worshiped in Westerly. Even today, Westerly has deep Sabbatarian roots. In fact, the local newspaper never published on Saturday. They never published on Saturday, owned by the Utter family. And even until, I think they've sold it now, the Westerly Sun never published on Saturday, even till recent years. So Westerly, Rhode Island. Now, the interesting thing here is that you have the first meeting house was actually built in Westerly, but it's since burned down, but it was in 1680. And here it says 3,000 people were baptized in the Pawcatuck River who were members of the Sabbatarian Church in Hopkinton, Rhode Island. This is the famous Boom Bridge. A lot of the deeds and things in this part of Rhode Island have listed the Sabbath. There was what's called a Sabbath path, and they'll give the borders of a piece of property. It'll say the Sabbath path is over here, and they talk about Boom Bridge. Boom Bridge is a road that's it's no longer in operation. It's shut down. There was a bridge there called the Boom Bridge. It's no longer, you can't drive across it anymore. But this was the location where the Sabbath keepers, this is Connecticut over here and this is Rhode Island over here. So the Sabbath keepers, instead of going way upstream to cross at a bridge, they crossed here. They had a tree that they cut down and they made a boom out of it, and they would put someone on the end here and swing them across over here so they could go to church. And it's recorded in the minutes that so-and-so showed up at church soaking wet because they fell off Boom Bridge. But they still came to church even soaking wet, and walked by the minister if they were late. This is where they crossed on the Boom Bridge. This is where the original building built in 1680 stood. This is called the Minister's Monument. It's located in the Westerly Cemetery. Many of these headstones will have notice of the Sabbath keepers because they're all buried here. This is where the original building was. It was built there in 1680. It burned down. They built another one, and then they moved it into town. And so the people were so upset they moved the church 3 miles into town. They refused to go. You know, it's been told to me that if you want to divide a church, build a building. And so they moved the building. And so they organized the group that remained, what they call the Squatters Church of God, which existed on this spot for many years because they refused to go into town to where the church building had been moved. These are all the pastors of the church beginning in 1680, going all the way up to the 1900s. They buried their pastors around here. We just hope they were all dead when they buried them. But they buried them. They even have a few open slots here for future pastors to be buried. And of course, today they're called Seventh-day Baptists. This is the gate to Brown University. Brown University was also founded for religious purposes. It was originally called Rhode Island College. Then there was a donation of land by Nicholas Brown in Providence, Rhode Island, and it became known as Brown University, which is a major Ivy League school today. Brown University was begun by seven individuals. Four of them were Sabbath keepers, and three of them were Sunday keepers. The first president of Brown University was a Sabbath keeper by the name of James Manning. He was a member of the Sabbath-keeping church. Brown University has no acknowledgement of this at all. They have Manning Hall, and they have a picture of James Manning. This is the painting that hangs there. He was a Sabbath keeper. So there's some deep roots in Rhode Island. We found some interesting documents in the various libraries. This is the John Hay Library, the Rockefeller Library. I found a copy of Samuel Hubbard's journal, which what we were told was burned in a fire and no longer exists. And I was literally in the basement of Rockefeller Library, and it's in the basement, so they have this light switch that you turn it on and it counts down and it goes off. And so I'd have to keep going back and turning it on, turning it off. Well, it went off one time, and there was another individual with me helping me, and he went over to turn it on, and I had my hand, true story, I had my hand on a book that I was leaning up against, and I pulled it out, and it was Samuel Hubbard's journal, in which he talks about observing the Sabbath and what it meant to them. They recorded the date they began keeping the Sabbath, but not the date of their birth. This was the most important day to them when they began observing the Sabbath. And we found that, discovered that here, and it's now acknowledged that it does exist, but we were told it does not exist, that it had been lost. This is the Rhode Island State House. It's the only state capitol that's all marble. It's completely made out of marble from Georgia. And they recognize their roots. They have on the top of the capitol what's called the free man, which is kind of a combination of a Roman and a Greek soldier standing with a spear. He represents freedom. And that's what they were founded for, freedom of religion. As I said, today, the Catholics have a stranglehold. Between the Catholics and organized crime, Rhode Island is, you know, that's where what they have. But they were founded for freedom, and it was a location where the church could come. And from here, they went to Pennsylvania and New Jersey, to Iowa, and then to Oregon, where in 1920s, Herbert Armstrong came into contact with the Sabbath keepers that traced their thread all the way from southern France through England to Rhode Island to New Jersey to Iowa, Pennsylvania, and then to Oregon. It's quite a story. Here's an interesting picture that a member sent to me from New Jersey. Notice this. It's called Quibbletown, New Jersey. It says a colonial hamlet which was so named because of discussion as to whether Saturday or Sunday is the Sabbath. And so the name of the town is Quibbletown because the Sabbatarians settled here and it created quite a dispute. Let's go back to where we started. The prophecy, Matthew 16, verse 18. Very important prophecy. Christ said, I will build my church and the gates of Hades, or the grave, shall never prevail against it. The church has existed since it was founded in 31 AD. The challenge is, where do you find it? I can't tell you, as I make this presentation, that every single person was a part of the true church. Everyone that I'm showing you were Sabbath keepers. The true church was among them. They came from southern France to England to Rhode Island, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Iowa, and then Oregon. We traced the trail through the Sabbath. But as I also quoted 2 Timothy 2, verse 19, God knows those who are his. So God knows, even though we don't know. This is the story of the church. It's a very narrow portion. It's a continuation of what we read in Revelation chapter 2 and 3, the various stages and epochs of the church leading up to the return of Jesus Christ. No matter what happens, the church will not be destroyed. The church will not die. It will be alive when Jesus Christ returns. Our challenge is to be a part of that. There are three things we must do. We must focus on what we're doing. We must focus on what we're doing. We must also do more than that. We must focus on what we're doing. We must acknowledge, of course, the God that we serve. We must be committed to serving God in this way of life. This is what God called us for. He gave us to be a part of this. There are those that went before us. There will be those, of course, that will go beyond us. The church will not die. We're a part of that. God called us to be a part of that. We need to focus on who we are. We need to understand our heritage. We need to know where we're going and what God has called us for. I hope you got something out of it. I hope you at least enjoyed this sort of journey through history. It's my story. It's a unique story. I've told it many, many times over the years, and I always enjoy telling it. I usually say, turn the lights out, open up the popcorn. There's nothing that's going to be, you know, really controversial. There's no correction in my sermon. It's all about the story, and I hope you've enjoyed it.